What a day this has been so far. I do want to thank particularly the person, the organizer who's not speaking at all, Dave Kraft. He told me a while back that he saw the China Syndrome, that film, 32 years ago or so, and that made him become an anti-nuclear activist. So if you haven't seen the China Syndrome yet, you better go see it. But what extraordinary dedication Dave and others have had for all these decades when so many Americans became complacent, enough that young Americans didn't know there was anti-nuclear activism after Three Mile Island that kept new reactors from being built here. And so my title, Where Are the People, was actually a title given by Dave. It was also assigned to the first panel this morning. And it comes from a moment of sheer, puzzled rage that I felt. Now, among the people terribly, terribly upset about Fukushima are the nuclear industry, right? On this campus, about a month after Fukushima, there was a very big deal dog and pony show put on by Argonne National Laboratory. And you knew it was a big deal because the refreshments were really expensive, much more than anything that humanists would put on. And I was very struck that there was never any mention of the impact of Fukushima on human beings. And I remember asking about labor. What was going to happen? The Soviet Union was a command economy at that time. It could just order people in to deal with the Chernobyl catastrophe. Japan can't do it in the same way. And one of the experts on the panel simply said, you just throw more money at them. So there was that mention of human beings, right? They're susceptible to having money thrown at them. And then there was another one, this one possibly even more august, sponsored by the American Academy of Sciences, where a number of our experts participated. And it was after that I just turned around to Dave and said, there are no people. None of them is ever thinking about human beings. And so, therefore, the title and my assignment. So all of that damage control on nuclear power was being done here in the days and months after Fukushima. And the fact that human beings went unaddressed, I think, was not accidental at all. In fact, if you go back to the very beginning, the nuclear age has required thinking, either bracketing human beings altogether, identifying a portion of them as expendable, or both. And so that's what I want to talk about a little bit and then go on to think about the human impact of Fukushima and on all of us. In some ways, talking about expendability, we heard very, very powerful presentations this morning from Native Americans and talking about how their homelands have been desecrated and made dangerous for everyone and generations past and to come as well. And the kinds of language you see when you go back to the early Cold War days, the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission, for example, referred to downwinders in the American Southwest as, quote, low-use segment of the population. Another quote from an Atomic Energy Commission official, quote, Nevada is a damn good place to dump used razor blades, close quote. Or one of the things that's been interesting to see is that you can employ people in the nuclear industrial complex, or you can as the U.S. military or workers at plants. You can just use them that way, and you can dispose of waste that way. You can really double your profits if you manage to make them experimental subjects as well, right? You use the people that you've dumped on, and you generate scientific data. And I'm not saying that scientific data isn't important. On the contrary, I think it is. But this vicious exploitation is very hard to tolerate. So this one is an example that comes from the Marshall Islands. I hope many of you know about extensive U.S. atmospheric testing in the Marshall Islands and how devastating that was for Native peoples there. Now, this is somebody from the Advisory Committee on Biology and Medicine of the AEC saying, speaking on the benefits of studying the impact of testing in the Marshall Islands, quote, "Now, data of this type has never been available. While it is true that these people do not live, I would say, the way Westerners do, civilized people, here's the punchline, it is nevertheless also true that these people are more like us than mice." Okay? More like us than mice. Thank you for volunteering your bodies. It's interesting that on the Marshall Islands, their national day, once they gained independence, so to speak, the ambassador from the United States comes and thanks the Marshallese people for having contributed to the freedom of the world. Okay, and in some ways, if we go even back to the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there are people who say, people none other, for example, than the French feminist, great feminist writer Simone de Beauvoir in her novel The Mandarins, who say, after VE Day has taken place, they the Americans would never have dared to drop this on white people. And there are other, I have met African Americans who lived through that period, New Yorkers, who said, oh, we said that to each other all the time then. Be that as it may, we also have to remember, I mean, as part, as was referred to briefly this morning, there were atomic scientists here who tried really, really hard to forestall the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima. And Leo Szilard, for example, made extraordinary efforts. And if you want to look further into this, Google the July 17th petition of the Manhattan scientists. I think that is important also because many people will say, well, the scientists and the politicians didn't really know what the impact was going to be. They did know. They knew enough to try frantically to try to stop it. There's that, and it's a strange kind of disconnect we see in that kind of endeavor, the effort to start up world government because the Manhattan, the atomic scientists felt the danger of the bomb, thought it couldn't be trusted to one nation. They fall victim to McCarthyism and red purging. And then we just go into the Cold War mode, it seems. Now, then there's another category of subjects, human subjects. Does anyone here know about the House Subcommittee report dating from 1986? It's titled American Nuclear Guinea Pigs, Three Decades of Radiation Experimentation on U.S. Citizens. Anybody know about this? Yeah, it's a wonderful, it's a very, very valuable document, I think. The subcommittee was chaired by Ed Markey, and he was reporting to John Dingell, who is still representing some of the people of Michigan in Congress. I just looked through it to pick out some examples of University of Chicago involvement, right? We might as well focus on where we are. One of the examples I found was as part of the Manhattan Project between 1945 and 1947 was not just the University of Chicago, but Oak Ridge in Tennessee and Strong Memorial Hospital in Rochester, University of California in San Francisco. 18 patients were, quote, injected with plutonium to measure the quantity retained by the human body. Were they told? Absolutely not. Of course, plutonium, I learned through reading this that plutonium was a word that could not be used during the war. These were people who were selected because their physicians thought they had illnesses that left them with fewer than 10 years to live. And I think, are you kidding? You think 10 years is nothing to a human being? Anyway, And as it turns out, some of them died in 5 years, some of them died in 20, but certainly they were not informed, and their survivors, and perhaps their survivors and some of them were informed only in 1974. This next one is in some ways, it's very revelatory because I've been talking about expendable subjects, and I think one of the things we have to remember is that there are people who are minorities, people in weak positions, economically vulnerable people who can be singled out as expendable. But what, it's like Bonhoeffer, was it Bonhoeffer talking about, you know, if when the Nazis come for so-and-so, I didn't stand up, and finally they come for you. You realize that we are all subjects of human experimentation in the nuclear age. But this one is between 1961 to 63, taking place at the University of Chicago and Argonne National Laboratory, 102 human subjects. Now, who might they be? The subcommittee report says students and researchers' staffs, some of whom are labeled volunteers, 102 human subjects. Now, if you're an undergraduate and your professor asks you to take part in an experiment, would you be able to say no? If you were the secretary to a researcher, now why didn't the researchers experiment on themselves, one could ask. They didn't, as far as I know. Okay, what was done with these human subjects? They were fed real fallout from the Nevada test site. Simulated fallout particles that contain strontium, barium, or cesium, or solutions of strontium and cesium. This experiment was designed to measure human absorption and retention. I'm quoting here. Human absorption and retention of these radioactive substances. The Department of Energy reported no long-term medical follow-up on these subjects. A scientific paper was published, I think, in 64 or so, but apparently no effort to follow up on these people. I've been talking a bit about expendable populations, and I always think about a Cuban psychiatrist that a bunch of us who went with the wonderful Alison Bowden, former dean of Rockefeller Chapel, to on a University of Chicago trip to Cuba 2004. This Cuban psychiatrist said about HIV/AIDS, in Cuba had a distinctive experience. They were excoriated in the Western, and I remember the Japanese press for hurting AIDS and HIV patients. We do have another word for it, which is quarantine, but that wasn't the word applied in the case of Cuba. Anyhow, and then Cuba goes on, after a period of great suffering, to develop retrovirals on their own steam. But this physician said, the experience of dealing with AIDS, HIV patients taught us something fundamental about society, that whenever there is a crisis, the vulnerable suffer more. All of us suffer, but the vulnerable suffer more. And I think what has happened in Fukushima and Chernobyl and the many other sites of nuclear production and experimentation, whether they have resulted in disasters that can't be concealed or not, whether it's much more subtle, I think what's happened is irreparable and irreversible, given the nature of radioactive substances. And I think the question that is before us today is it irredeemable? What can we do to redeem the profound, lasting injuries we have done to our, as Al Gore said at the end of his movie, our only home, the Earth, and to our fellow living creatures? And Jeff Patterson today's point emphasized, he had a couple of triplets, but the one I want to bring up now, secrecy and deception, cover-up, minimization. Secrecy, cover-up, minimization. When authorities are dealing with nuclear incidents. I think that that is what gets us to this point, that nuclear power, weapons and energy, both, threatens us fundamentally as biological and social beings. And going back to the title that Dave Kraft gave me, The People, Where Are the People?, let's not forget that democracy has a root, the Greek word demos, which means the people. Nuclear power is incompatible with we the people, with any genuine notion of democracy. So before I explore some of these issues further, I want to dispose of one common question quickly. I found many people saying to me after Fukushima, in Japan of all places, they've already suffered once. How could it possibly happen there? Well, as in other places, it's not that special in that sense. It's just that there was a little extra labor that had to go in. One is in a neutral way, the scientific experiment imperative, that they're Japanese scientists, physicists, indeed even very progressive physicists, liberals and leftists, who had known about nuclear experimentation, that search before the war, and who were eager to resume it after the war. That desire to know. So oftentimes we are somehow made to think that scientists are very special people, and if they want to know something, if they want to find something else out, they uniquely are entitled to having that desire acknowledged and accepted. Why? That's one thing, scientific imperative. The other one, of course, is something that's come up a lot today, Atoms for Peace. And we all know how nuclear war was conceptually normalized under President Eisenhower through that program. But for Japan, there was even a reasoning amongst American officials that because of Hiroshima, therefore, nuclear technology was owed to the Japanese people. That it was indeed a Christian task to impart this technology to Japanese. And that Japanese people, on the other hand, on the receiving end, had to be gotten over what was patronizingly called by Japanese who were eager to promote this technology, had to be gotten over their nuclear allergy. And gotten over it, they were. You know, there was all the talk of bringing wealth through, you know, too cheap to meter, wealth to depopulating communities, so forth and so on. The same dreary and dreadful pattern of seduction happened in Japan too. And another one that I think is very important, a number of you might have seen an op-ed in the New York Times with Frank von Hippel, whose name came up today, and a Japanese writer, a few days ago called Japan's Nuclear Mistake, in which the authors say it's not good for proliferation reasons for Japan to continue to rely on nuclear power, but quickly dismiss the possibility that Japan would veer from its anti-nuclear weapons policy. But it is clear to many people, experts who've studied this, that the attraction of nuclear power, nuclear energy in Japan, as elsewhere, has been that it could be a latent nuclear weapons power. And in fact, the former lamentable but not lamented governor of Tokyo, who's now left that position to run for national political office, start up a new group, just said, because he was aligning with an almost equally unpleasant person, new power broker Hashimoto from Osaka, that he had made a big thing about distancing himself from nuclear power, and former Governor Ishihara just said, I'm going to make them take that out of the party statement, party platform, because we Japanese cannot afford to give up on the possibility of being a nuclear weapons power. So people shouldn't be sanguine about Japan and its nuclear weapons ambitions. Also, just one other thing, people have often said to me, Japanese people don't protest, and we've seen over the summer that that's not true. But it was also true a long, long time ago. And for example, in 1950, with the Stockholm Appeal, some of you may know about this, right? There were 273.5 million signatories worldwide, 6.4 million in Japan, and 3 million in the US. Those who became involved in signing this appeal to ban nuclear weapons, to think of this as a crime against humanity, were quickly red purged under the occupation. In March 1954 was the Lucky Dragon incident, and housewives in one ward in Tokyo launched an anti-nuclear campaign and gathered 32 million signatures. 1954 is well before social media. So another thing, maybe there is something to be said about face-to-face contact and bringing your clipboard and talking to individuals. I mean, it's really an extraordinary number, which the current movement has not been able to achieve, in that, you know, they were trying to get 10 million signatures by April, was it? And now it's just been extended, and I think it's at 70 or 80, 10 million, and it's now at 6 million or so. Okay. Back to secrecy. The United States occupation, well, the United States having dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, then proceeds to have pretty much a unilateral rather than allied occupation of Japan, which turned out to be absolutely significant for the future that post-war Japan would have. But the occupation forbade any dissemination of information or images of the atomic bombs, right? So people were not, they could not talk about, they couldn't publish anything on it. There's a lot of, great deal of censorship that went on in the under the occupation that was all about bringing American liberal values to this, until ever so recently, enemy fascist country. But so be it. I remember those years well, and this is in a way how I come to be before you today, was that my father was part of the U.S. occupation. My mother was a woman, Japanese woman, he met and married in that context, fought a lot at the breakfast table about U.S. atmospheric testing. My father said it was absolutely necessary because of those commies. And my mother, who was an Adlai Stevenson follower, was absolutely horrified. And since I knew then already that my mother was right and my father inevitably and necessarily wrong, I kind of was set on the right path on the nuclear issue very early on. And I want to share with you a poem that is in your packets, but it's the place I often return to think about the nuclear issue. It was a poem written just about that time, right at the end of the occupation, when the first images of the atomic bomb, of the victims, in other words, the people on Ground Zero, remember the Smithsonian 17 years ago now, would not allow an exhibit which showed the experience of the atomic bombs on the ground. So they ended up with a refurbished Enola Gay. Now, what a complete way to learn about the impact of the atomic bombs was just to have the Enola Gay there. So this poet, a woman, this was a very, very heady time in Japan when so much that had been crushed during the war years and then even under the occupation was coming to life. So in the context of a union movement, marking of the anniversary of Hiroshima, she showed up at work and was told to produce a poem. So this is her poem, having just seen her first image of an atomic bomb victim. Upon seeing a photograph of an atomic bomb victim, this burnt, oozing face of August 6th, 1945, belonged to someone in Hiroshima at that moment, one of the 250,000 burnt, oozing things no longer of this world. Even so, my friend, let us look once again into the faces we have turned toward each other. Faces without a trace of the flames of war. Faces of today, radiant with health, morning fresh faces. When I search there for the expression tomorrow could bring, a shudder passes through me. The earth holds 700 nuclear weapons. How, when you walk the abyss between life and death, can you be so serenely beautiful? Hush and listen. Can you hear something coming? What needs to be seen is before your eyes. What needs to be chosen is in the palm of your hand. 8:15 a.m. comes around every day. That morning of August 6, 1945, all those 250,000 people who died instantly were, like you, like me, serenely beautiful, caught off guard. So the title of the poem actually is Greetings. Greetings to each other. Greetings to this face of a once beautiful young woman, so transfigured. For many years, when I read this poem, I was transfixed by this posing of a moment, the focus on the sharp divide between before and after, right? Robert Chavez gave a very powerful talk to us today about turning on the tap, getting drops of fresh water, breathing in fresh, filling your lungs with fresh air. So I long read this poem as that, and especially after Fukushima too. The moment before that, you can just turn on the water in your kitchen and you can drink it quench your thirst as much as you want and breathe deeply, fill your lungs. And the moment after, you can't do that. So I've been caught on that moment. And think about, you know, the moment before crisis when life is forever transformed. And ask myself, what precipice are we sitting on the edge of now? And I don't mean the fiscal cliff, of course, but with this mountain of waste. But in thinking about this conference, I've begun to think more and more about how that divide might not be so sharp, and how the moment of being off guard can extend for months, years, decades, including after as well as before crisis. And in the first place, the crisis itself may be invisible like radiation, as long as there isn't a bombing like the Hiroshima, Nagasaki, or the atmospheric tests, or a quote-unquote accident as Three Mile Island or Chernobyl or Fukushima. So as kinds, I've come to think that there are many kinds of being off guard, some of which are, for example, the condition of living with a nuclear power or reprocessing plant, of, in the case of Japan or elsewhere, believing the safety myth, and then keeping secret to yourself worries. We have a handy pop psychological word for that, denial, right? Denial gets us through. I mean, it is truly functional. And I'm thinking that when Jeff gave us secrecy this morning as one of the prime characteristics of the nuclear industrial complex, we also need to think about secrecy not only on the part of the government or the corporation, of local people who promote it, but secrecy on the part of those of us who become subjected to it. Of alienation from one's own anxieties, the effort it takes to keep on denying something you suspect. It is also something I think that Robert Chavez's talk got at, that so often we are asked to choose between life and livelihood. Again, we're not all posed that choice equally. That's where there's a great deal of social injustice, but it's a terrible, terrible balance, and there should be no need in the 21st century for anyone to have to choose their lives over their livelihood, and yet that's a question that's constantly being posed. Another kind of being off guard is that after the disaster, simply getting used to living with those conditions. Akiko Yoshida today talked about, in response to a question, saying there are two kinds of people left in Fukushima, those who would like to leave but can't because of reasons of their work or really financial constraints or possibly family reasons, and those who prefer to leave, to believe in the government. And I'm thinking that even on the part of the former, that those who choose to believe that what the government is saying, that they're in safe enough places, that they themselves must have suspicions, right? And that they are alienated from their own victimization. So there's that kind of being off guard, is simply getting used to things. And this is a hard one. I'm thinking that some forms of support, even, for victims might be a version of being caught off guard. I'll try to elaborate on that a bit. And I'm going to turn to somebody who's really been a lodestone for me in how to think about Fukushima, a woman, Ruiko Muto, from Fukushima, who lost her own livelihood because she was living in the foothills of mountains, running a cafe and serving a lot of natural things. She is one of those people who began to oppose nuclear power after Chernobyl, and the reason she did was that she began to study it, and she decided that every stage of the generation of nuclear power, from people involved in uranium mining to people who transport it, I mean, and all the processes of milling it, it's enriching it, that somebody is being exposed to radiation every step of the way, and she simply could not condone not opposing that form of power. Now, I was really thrilled to see that Kristen Iverson, in her magnificent book on Rocky Flats, quotes a part of the speech which was given at the first major gathering, I think electrified everyone because it helped people feel what it was like to live in Fukushima after the disaster. And I'm just going to quote a quick part of it, a short part of it, quickly, and you can find parts of it in the epilogue in Kristen's book, and you can also find the whole speech online translated. Okay, quote, caught between the campaign launched ever so quickly to proclaim our safety on the one hand and our own uncertainty on the other, the ties holding us together have been sundered. In our neighborhoods, our workplaces, at school, and at home, how many of us have suffered and grieved. Like it or not, decisions are pressed upon us every day. To flee or not to flee, to eat or not to eat, it's a series of Hamlet-like questions. To hang out our wash or not to hang it out. To make our children wear masks or not to force them to. To till our fields or not to till them. To protest to someone, something, or remain silent. All manner of agonizing decisions have confronted us. And these questions are the ones that I think she's to me so helpful, because she's not trapped by false divisions. So we have been divided by the forces, by a government that refused to take responsibility, never mind TEPCO itself. And there are people in Fukushima who will say, for all the problems with the Soviet Union, that compulsory evacuation 3 days later is something that could have helped us. It could have helped, for example, in families where the father-mother generation, even the father might have wanted to leave, but the mother-in-law says, no, I've got to stay here. So it could have cut down on some of those intra-family disputes, because if the government orders you to leave, you leave. But of course, the government didn't want to pay that much money or take such responsibility. So these divisions that have been produced in Fukushima are overlaid and aggravating what was already an acute economic divide in Japan. Japan, I would say, through late 1990s, had the lowest income gap of the G7, now the G8, you know, the richest countries in the world, between the highest income earners and the lowest. And by 2005, I think it was second only to the United States. And I have read since then that by some indices, inequality in Japan exceeds that of the United States, which is a major achievement, you have to admit, right? To show greater inequality than the United States. And it's tragic, because what Japan had achieved post-war was a widespread middle-class society. Now, middle-class is not everything, but it's a lot. Okay, so the kinds of divisions between the communities that site plants, house waste, and their interests, economic development, employment, although that has been exaggerated too, and this is obviously a factor in the United States as well, between those places that produce the electricity and those that consume it, this has became a very big deal after Fukushima, as Tokyoites, some of them, felt with a pang that the people in northern Japan, in Fukushima, were not the beneficiaries of this electricity. It was being generated for Tokyoites, but it would be too dangerous to have a nuclear power plant in Tokyo. Between those who can afford relative safely and those who can't, between those who can buy safe food and those who can't, I'll try to give examples from my direct experience, what people have told me directly. A niece of a friend with a baby was so furious at all the rich people buying up the food grown from Osaka West that she decided she was not going to worry at all. She was just going to eat whatever food she could buy that was affordable. And my friend said, well, what about the baby? She says, oh, the baby's the same too. We're just not going to worry. So not being able to, not having choices, can lead to that state of just becoming indifferent. She at least had the energy to be angry. You can just become indifferent from your hopelessness. A friend of mine whose husband runs, it's a K through, no, maybe it's just a middle school through college, and found after Fukushima that so many parents from Fukushima were trying to send middle school age children to go to this school, which is in one of the metropolitan prefectures. And the husband would explain that, no, we have a policy that junior high students cannot be living away from their parents. They said, no, we absolutely have to make sure that our children aren't identified with Fukushima so that they won't suffer for employment and marriage prospects. So this I think, is a legacy of Hiroshima, is the marriage issue, and even we've recently I've seen in the paper reports of Fukushima men complaining that young women don't want to marry them. But a lot of secrecy, victim secrecy, took place after the atomic bombings because people were worried that their children would not be able to get married or be well employed. I once asked a very interesting, wonderful American historian who teaches at the Hiroshima Peace Institute. I asked him, so do you see this kind of phenomenon among Hanford downwinders of worrying about marriage? He says, no, Americans are in such denial about the dangers of radiation that there's no discrimination. I don't know if that's true. I'd be very eager to hear. I think what happens a lot in the U.S. is people worry about property values, right? That seems much more out in the open. Don't talk about this because it'll make the property values go down. Whereas marriageability is a huge issue in Japan. Another friend told me that one of his neighbors had her son driving back from Fukushima on weekends, and the neighbors complained about having a car with a Fukushima license plate, didn't want it to be parking, so he offered his own parking lot. There's a single nuclear reactor on the northernmost island of Hokkaido, which is sort of like my second home. And only after Fukushima did I hear that there was a rumor that girls from that area couldn't get married. And I asked a scientist from Hokkaido University whether that was true. He said, well, of course, you know, the breast cancer rates are so much higher in that area than in the eastern part. So these are the kinds of divisions and tensions that are created, and also secrecy among those who have been victimized. Another kind of tension about staying or leaving, of course, who can afford, and recovery. Listening to Robert Chavez and Charmaine Whiteface today and talking about, I mean, something I knew abstractly but had a new power to me about how contaminated their homelands have become, and yet how they want to continue to live in their homelands because homeland is a meaningful thing, made me think about my own worry and even criticism of people insisting on staying in Fukushima for the sake of staying. And that, even though I know how difficult it is to get up and leave, and I remember screening a film many of you may have seen called The Chernobyl Heart a number of years ago, and students were astonished and said, well, why don't these people just leave? And I thought, okay, you're University of Chicago undergrads, you think that if you decide you don't like a place, you can just up and leave, and it's not easy, not easy. So I'm well aware of that, and I just wish that there were systematic government support for allowing people to move, not just with their children, but their old folk to safer places. But on the other hand, we get campaigns like support the people of Fukushima by eating their produce, right? Support by eating. And it becomes particularly charged when you have organic farmers who have invested so much of themselves into producing safe food, and that was becoming one of the hallmarks. Like, unlike China, Japan produces safe food. And some have given up, but many want to stay, and they've kind of put all their life's determination into saying, I'm going to produce safe food. And as a great graduate student in sociology, who was one of your servers tonight, has taught me to think about, okay, so supposing that these people can produce food that's safe, that really is safe for consumers, what about them? What does it mean for these organic farmers to be working the soil in the contaminated areas? You know, so we can't just be thinking of the consumers and their safety, although market mentality encourages that. Or, you know, festivals like this in Soma, the 750-year-old festival of chasing the wild horses was revived almost in full scale this year. Now, you think about it, right? These horses, a number of those who were fit enough, were evacuated to Hokkaido in 2011. I guess they've come back. Think about what do horses do when they're running? They kick up dust, right? There's no way you can have horses running along. And you're attracting crowds. And on the one hand, it is energizing for people. It's like it's a sign of this whole discourse of recovery, which the government has promoted like crazy, and local governments too, is one that bothers me immensely because it seems like a version of cover-up. On the one hand, on the other hand, people need to go on living their everyday lives. What is it that will give them the energy to do so? But this kind of, you know, having reviving athletic meets for students, all of that seems very, very problematic to me. As does support by accepting irradiated detritus, rubble, right? I think the city of Osaka just incinerated over 3 days at the end of November, rubble. And the government, of course, spread that around, and to refuse to oppose this was made to seem like a NIMBY reaction, not in my backyard. But I don't think it is. What happens if you spread this rubble all over Japan and incinerate it with varying filters or not is you're making no place safe in Japan. There's no place even to send children once you do this thoroughly enough. And I think that's a deliberate part of the government, act on the part of the government, by saying it's unpatriotic, you're not showing solidarity, but it is also tacitly saying, look, the whole archipelago is now contaminated. You have no choice but to live with it. Of course, no one is going to say this, and I will not in any way be able to tolerate it. But this is what's happening. So I'm thinking, this was a very amazing example to me. A friend told me that her nephew, who had evacuated to another part of northern Japan, gone back to start high school, has been instructed by his school to go to school. He commutes to school on a bicycle wearing a disposable raincoat. This is a school rule. He gets to the school, removes the raincoat. The way home, he gets a new disposable raincoat that he wears going back to school. What's being done to these raincoats, you know, with all these students wearing a set every day? Why is it considered acceptable to have children going to school in those circumstances? But that is, in another of those handy words that habituate us to a situation, the new normal. So I think this, the not wanting to know, the not wanting to acknowledge ourselves as victims, is also a part of being caught off guard. It's a kind of it's alienation from oneself. It's keeping a profound part of yourself secret to yourself. And in the midst of all this, I want to finish up quickly, so if we want discussion, we can have a little bit of it. On the one hand, sometimes I feel as if Fukushima had never happened, even in Japan, the way the restart of the Oi reactor over what is now widely acknowledged to be an active fault. All of that, and then the very loud voice that the economic interests have of dire predictions about what will happen. And because Japan, you see, has been in this 20-year post-bubble recession, the claim about what will happen to unemployment if we give up on nuclear power is very powerful. So amidst that kind of thing, I think there are also new kinds of ties and self-expression spawned by Fukushima. Some of you know about the Skilled Veterans Service Corps of retirees with technical backgrounds who want to be able to go into Fukushima to spare younger workers exposure. It's also the people in the SBCF are doing this out of, many of them, you know, they rode the tide of the Japanese economic miracle, and it's a reflection for many of them on what that economic miracle was worth. And the people like Ruiko Muto, when we talked earlier about lack of accountability and liability, who are demanding that TEPCO and other responsible individuals be charged for this. The Japanese judicial system is complicated, so it's a multi-step process, but on the one hand, that they be charged, but also as part of joining this legal effort, the effort to talk to people, she's told me about, from people who, from the inner part of Fukushima, who feel safe and who feel that they are really been victimized by the harmful rumors, another kind of doublespeak, and not really damaged, and by talking to them, to get them to understand that they too are victims, right? To do some of the secrecy that one has maintained to oneself. So there's a general election coming up on December 16th. I hope you will watch the results to see what happens. I think that the demonstrations over the summer were so successful that there's an enormous desire on the part of many to clamp down, to see we simply cannot allow nuclear power to be questioned. So in that sense, again, we're back to nuclear power as a fundamental challenge to democracy. So my question, how do we redeem life, this life on this degraded planet and still our only home? How do we redeem life, individual and social, in this place that we have hurt so deeply? But which, when I say we, I want to say we are not all equally responsible, and for which future generations are not responsible at all. Thank you very much for listening.
We've got about 5 or 6 minutes. Okay, we'll take about 3 questions. We got about 5 or 6 minutes. Then we're going to hear from David Kraft. Dave Kraft.
Maybe we can get to
it. Is there an anti-nuclear party that has risen up from the masses that is running in this next federal election?
There's a new party, the Future Party, that emerged last week. You know, I was saying to someone that we just had a presidential election, right, in which I hear $6 billion were spent by both sides, and there's a part of me that says, what if the $6 billion had been spent on public education or housing, you know, school, health? In Japan, educations are very short. They're announced and you have like 2 weeks, little over 2 weeks. And it's both of these models of elections are absurd. So the new party is just established last week. They are ahead of the others, and the head is a 62-year-old governor of Shiga Prefecture, which is in sort of central western Japan. Communist Party and Social Democrats and some other splinter groups are supporting, but this party has stated as its position, ending reliance on nuclear power in 10 years. So we'll see how that goes. The Democratic Party, the ruling party, so-called, the Prime Minister Noda has waffled on this one way or the other, and now I think he's kind of getting back to saying in 30 years. But it remains to be seen how it is an issue I think that the electorate are keenly interested in, but whether in 2.5 weeks sufficient organizations, especially as campaign laws have become more and more and more stringent to a degree I can't believe. We'll see how much organizing can take place.
Yeah. I'm kind of going to ask the same question that was asked earlier today. But we did see a movie about the people who were organic farmers in Japan, and it was really very sad. But is there some kind of biological remediation? I mean, if you mushrooms or algae or something, or bacteria, I mean, you would have to do something with the mushrooms after they ate up all the... I mean, that's just assuming that they sucked up the radiation. But is there any kind of work with that at all?
I think there are a lot of experiments. I don't know anything that is substantially reliable. People do all, you know, there was for a period relying on sunflowers, right? And we still see them, and I think they're cheering. So, and that's worth something, but... And mustard seed, yes, that's being tried too. But whatever you grow, if that is effective in absorbing radiation from the soil, you have to then deal with that plant. So, and then there are binding agents like zeolite that are being used. But I myself don't know anything that people are placing very firm, well, I think has a good chance of being reliable. But if others know more about these experiments, I'd be glad to hear.
Just to follow up on the discussion here, I think it's important to understand that radioactive materials are highly unique in that regard, is that you don't clean up radioactive materials. It's not, you move them around.
Exactly.
You absorb them, concentrate them and move them somewhere else, because they are radiotoxic. In other words, their properties are due to their radioactive properties themselves, and that these properties are really a function of their half-lives and how they interact biologically in the in the biosphere. And so there is no, unfortunately, there is no sort of magic or silver bullet that will somehow, some mushroom will somehow soak this up and you can move it. It's really, we have to make terrible social decisions that have to do with environmental triage and triage involving human beings.
Yeah, in fact, I just learned, I'd always thought this word, the Japanese word for decontamination, josen, is peculiar, and I learned that it's not a very old word. It's the first character, the Sino-Chinese character is, Sino-Japanese character is remove, and the second character is contamination, remove. But before it used to, this was used as josetsu, like snow removal. Well, snow, at least pre-Fukushima, is very different from radioactive contamination. So you can see that the very language that's circulating in society is straining to accommodate and somehow make bearable this new unbearable reality.
Yeah, that sort of addresses my question. Could you address the way language, culture, and the humanities, the arts, your specialty, have been brought to counter the lies that engineering and science have been used to cover up?
Well, I think engineering and science are really indispensable too, and I don't think
they're dispensable, but they've been used to distract people from the humanity that's been put at stake.
Well, I think it's complicated because the Japanese government's recovery campaign, solidarity, bonds campaign, you know, my heart, your part, that's a humanistic campaign too. I think it's a crock up, you know, you can be humanistically covering up as much as you can be scientifically covering up. There's no guarantee that one discourse or practice or another is going to compel you to be more accurate and honest.
I was thinking of perhaps poetry or art that has come from...
I think art and poetry can be deceptive too. They don't have to be, but neither does science have to be deceptive. They can both be deceptive.
And you haven't seen that, you've seen both in Japan?
Sure. And it's very hard when people come, you know, a 100-year-old woman has written her haiku or waka about, you know, how don't let even your hearts be washed away by the tsunami, and you feel like saying, okay, you're 100 years old, you're well cared for by your secure middle-class grandchildren, great-grandchildren, people living on the ground, you know, may not find it so easy to keep their hearts from being washed away. So I feel that it's a delicate thing that we have to keep our eyes open and our hearts' eyes open. And, you know, we need everything, brain, heart, we need it all.
How has Japan managed with only two of 54 reactors?
Well, isn't that a great mystery? Well, first of all, I mean, it is true that fossil fuels have had to be relied on more, that's for sure. It's also true that Japanese citizens have gone on incredible campaigns to conserve. You know, they've really sweated out the summers because they want to produce the government and the power companies wrong, that they can't survive the summer without their air conditioning on all the time. There's that. And I don't... With colleagues and I maintain an Atomic Age website, the University of Chicago, where we post Japanese and English language materials. Very interesting article recently that some of you may know about the German concern E.ON, E-O-N, Aeon probably, complaining that with Germany's new policy that wind energy had gotten so cheap that utility prices were falling down, that they were going to have to report a loss to their stockholders. And that really made me wonder how, if we're not... Here's one thing I hope for, is I would like good energy economists who don't take nuclear energy as a necessary part of the mix to begin with, to start. We see signs of that in Japan. I would like to know the truth about what power mix is necessary and what happens to a society. And I guess we'll learn some of that tomorrow, but really from an economic point of view, since that seems to determine. Anyway, Japan has managed, and I'm sure that has really upset and panicked the authorities as well.